Hi, everybody. This is KLCC's weekly podcast, The Northwest Passage. I'm Rachel McDonald, news director at KLCC.
I'm the host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.
And I'm Karen Richards, a freelance reporter.
And I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
It's been another interesting week of news at KLCC, and we heard the latest story in our series, Native Voices, funded by the U of O Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics. We'll talk with Karen Richards in just a couple minutes about that story looking at Native artists. But first, Ani, what stories stood out for you this week in the news?
So yesterday, Oregon lawmakers in the House passed an extra $2 billion in funding for the state's struggling school system. I think we're 47th in terms of our graduation rate. This followed hours of debate. The chamber voted 37 to 21. Democrats are mostly in favor of it. Republicans are mostly not in favor of it. It's a huge tax package. They argue that the proposed business tax to fund the measure will be passed on to consumers through higher pricing. The vote comes a week before teachers across the state are planning a day of action. This is next Wednesday, May 8th, to protest what they say are decades of disinvestment in our public education system. Even if the tax package makes it through the Senate, opponents, meaning mostly Republicans, may pass the final choice along to the voters. So we may actually see that in a future election.
And I've heard from teachers this protest that they're doing has to do, the way they frame it, with student safety, because they're concerned that if schools aren't fully funded, classroom sizes are just too much.
So we have huge class sizes. We have we've covered this a lot on our air. We have enormous behavioral problems in classrooms and no support for those kids, which comes in the form of educational assistance and programs. So that's what they're going to be gathering for next week.
And we'll be covering that on KLCC. Ani, any other stories you've been paying attention to?
Sure. So speaking of things that may appear on our ballot, ballots are on the way to your mailbox right now in preparation for an election on May 21st. There aren't any statewide races this time, but there are races for seats on school boards, fire districts, and community college boards like LCC. Voters in Eugene are also going to be considering a five-year, $91 million operating tax levy for the 4J school district. And you've covered this a lot, Rachel. Lane County voters are also going to consider a request for a $154 million bond to build a replacement for our 60-year-old county courthouse.
So look for those ballots and listen to KLCC for more on the election coming up May 21st.
And then also, we had some more grim news about the fire season, which is quickly approaching. This week, the National Interagency Fire Center predicted a heavy early fire season in the Cascades. Earlier this week, you, Rachel, had a story about how After Heidi Drive or Forest Service Road 19 in the Willamette National Forest is still closed, and there's actually no estimate on when it's going to reopen. This is the road that takes you to Cougar Hot Springs. It's a really popular local destination, but it's also the site of last August's devastating Terwilliger fire. And actually, in revisiting this wildfire in preparation for recording this, I realized that it was still burning in November, which was huge.
November?
Yeah. It was, I think, 80% contained in November still. So we're still recovering from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all anticipating that the fire season is going to be pretty grim, whether it's bad here in Oregon, Washington, California. It's going to be a busy time.
Yeah, the West Coast is not, we're not getting a very good forecast for our fire season this summer, so be careful. And then one last thing is that though there are currently about 700 cases of measles throughout the U.S. right now, one of the year's first outbreaks, the one centered close to here in Southwest Washington, is officially over. This means it's been 6 weeks without a new infection. And ultimately, in this local outbreak, over 70 people, mostly unvaccinated children, were infected. And then a little update to a story we talked about on last week's podcast. I said that Oregon could become the first state to ban single-use styrofoam food service containers. Maine beat us to the punch. They signed that into – the governor signed that into law on Tuesday. So maybe we can be the second state.
Okay. Thanks, Ani. Brian, you had the fun job of interviewing Captain Kirk, William Shatner, this week. So tell us about that.
That I did. I got the opportunity to talk to William Shatner, best known to many Trekkies as Captain Kirk from the original series. The man is 88 years old.
Wow. What?
And traveling the country for a series of screenings of the 1982 Star Trek movie, The Wrath of Khan. And arguably, it's the favorite of all the films. I've watched them all. It's a sequel to the original series called Space Sea that had Ricardo Montalban as a genetic super being who takes over the Enterprises and causes lots of mayhem. But beyond the movie itself, Shatner has continued to do things such as doing music albums from the very quirky Transformed Man, which features the unforgettable rendition of Tambourine Man and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. It's really over the top.
Mr. Tambourine Man? Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man?
to his latest one, which came out late last winter, called Shatner Claus, his Christmas album. I kid you not. He's got a very definite stamp when he puts his name onto a product. It's definitely very William Shatner. He's also done books. He's done television roles outside of Star Trek, like T.J. Hooker and Boston Legal. And he also does some charity work, largely for equestrian organizations. He's really into horses. But I asked him about the many times he's been to Oregon. He's been to Portland. He's been to Eugene a few times, likes the college area. And I did enlighten him, though. I said, do you know what the Eugene Springfield connection is to Star Trek? And he said, I do not. And he wanted to know what that specific connection was. Theodore Sturgeon, a sci-fi writer of great renown, he grew up in the Staten Island area, I believe, but he retired and spent his final years here in Springfield, and then he passed away in a Eugene hospital in 1985 at the age of 67. He wrote two very famous Star Trek episodes. One was called Amok Time, where Spock gets called into what's called Pon Farr. I'm showing my geek stature here. The Vulcan mating ritual. And then he also wrote Shore Leave, about the Enterprise's crew's experiences on planet where even a passing thought or daydream becomes reality. And he's also credited with coming up with the Vulcan phrase, live long and prosper, and worked with actor Leonard Nimoy on developing the special Vulcan salute, which was very canon to the Star Trek series and, you know, the whole culture to this day. You know, before that, it was mostly, you know, thumbs up and keep on trucking, which wouldn't really work as a Vulcan thing, I guess. Anyway, it was an enjoyable conversation, and in a few weeks I'll be moderating a Q&A with William Shatner and the audience that comes to check out the Wrath of Khan at the Holt Center, May 19th.
So we can say live long and prosper, and the symbol has a connection to Springfield.
So, Brian, can you retire now that you've talked to Captain Kirk? Are you done?
Is that my bucket list?
I mean, it's like all of your bucket lists, right?
You know, if Mark Hamill came to Eugene and wanted to do a special screening of The Empire Strikes Back, I would not cough at that. But, yeah, the fact that Shatner came through and I was able to work and talk with him, I mean, that's kind of cool. It is pretty much high on the list now, even though it wasn't initially on the list.
So if Mark Hamill does come to Eugene, I might fight you for that interview, mm-hmm. just so you know.
All right.
Okay, so we've geeked out enough.
Yes.
Karen, you your feature that aired this week on KLCC, it looks at Native American artists and their efforts to gain recognition. What sparked your interest in this topic?
I was looking for something that was specific to that population. So, you know, all artists have problems with getting started in the business and, you know, finding ways to earn a living while building up enough of a backing to be in galleries and be selling pieces. And so I did look for ways that the organizations and the individuals who I spoke to had a different experience than just any artist in the mainstream. And I found that a couple of these organizations that are offer fellowships and offer grants started about 20 years ago. So at that point, there started to be some ability for these organizations to form and start giving help to some Native American artists. And now that that's been around for that long, they've established themselves and are starting to get works out into some big national galleries and to start to be able to offer more and more help to people. And then those people who had been helped as long as 20 years ago are coming into their own and able to reach back and help as well. So that was one aspect of it. And then it was interesting, the artists themselves I heard from both sides of some of them who really wanted to use the fact that they were part of this group to help them further their mm-hmm. art and be a part of shows or be able to take on grants and fellowships because of that, or sort of separate themselves and say, you know what, we should be beyond that now, and I want to be recognized as an artist no matter what group I'm a part of. So one of these clips starts out with Kyla Farrell-Smith, who actually graduated from high school in South Eugene and is a member of the Klamath tribe. And she was saying that she has been helped with a lot of these grants for Native Americans specifically, but that she's frustrated that within tribes, to even be enrolled in the tribe, they often say you have to have a certain percent of ancestry or blood quantum.
Even though there's honor and privilege to being a member of a tribe and I can access Native American art shows and exhibitions because I have that proof, I know other Native artists that don't have specific blood quantum and they can't get into art shows.
Native artists feel a push and pull with identifying as part of a group. Chacon, the composer, hopes people appreciate Indigenous artists for their individual talent.
I think what we are seeing is less exhibitions that are just focused on Native artists, just showcasing the work based on our identity, and you're seeing more and more Native artists included in major group exhibitions.
And so I think that back and forth kind of opens up these further questions and a bigger topic, which is, you know, even in a feature story, we often can't get to some of these deeper things. But what we can do is have something like a community conversation, which we have planned.
So, Karen, that community conversation is coming up on May 15th. That's a Wednesday evening from 5:30 to 7. It's at the LCC Longhouse on the Lane Community College campus. And you can find out more information on the community conversation for our Borders, Migration, and Belonging Native Voices series at our website, klcc.org. There you can also find Karen's story and all the stories that we've done over this past year. Brian Bull and Karen Richards have been doing this series on Native Voices, so you can find that at our website.
Mm-hmm. It feels strange to be winding down the series almost. I've got one piece coming out later this month that addresses the reintroduction of Indigenous staples, traditional foods, as a way to instill identity and history, culture into tribal communities, but also address some of the health issues that have affected Native Americans, such as the modern American highly processed diet. So I'm looking forward to that. Karen, have you thought ahead to what your last feature will be?
I have, and it is, as you say, it's interesting. It's going to be the last one. So that either of us will do. And I am thinking of ways to almost tie together the whole thing, so I won't give away my thoughts yet. But, you know, some way to sort of put a ribbon on it. But, yeah, I mean, I hope that a lot of the topics that we've brought up have gotten people thinking about these things. And I would love to see a lot of people show up and have a discussion together with a lot of the people that we've interviewed who will be on a panel, and with Brian and myself who have talk to many more people and, you know, just expand this a little bit with our listeners.
Great. Well, again, you can find the info at our website, klcc.org. You are listening to KLCC's Northwest Passage, and we are wrapping up this week by just talking about some of the stories that stuck with us from the news this week. So let's start with you, Brian.
Well, the big story statewide this week was a plague drill. Many of us have heard of the plague, read about in history books. It killed between some of the more conservative estimates, say between 20 to 30 million people in Europe during the Middle Ages. It's a disease that's either airborne or transmitted by infected rodents or fleas. This was a statewide exercise that utilized 1,000 personnel across the state, involving the Oregon Health Authority, Oregon State Police, and all 9 federally recognized tribes. And the scenario that they were working with was a bioterrorist incident where the plague was deliberately released in Portland, which is a great place for an exercise given it's the largest city and is a huge transportation hub by land, sea, and air. I talked to Akiko Saito, Director of Emergency Operations for the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division. She says the exercise is really to see how well the contagion is monitored and controlled, as well as how quickly antibiotics, what's called the Strategic National Stockpile, is distributed under police escort. And it bears mentioning that while words like plague and bioterrorism can alarm many of our listeners, the plague itself has been very readily, defanged, if you will, with modern-day antibiotics and control methods. We've learned a lot over the last 700 years in addressing pandemics. And in Oregon, there's been only 7 cases of the plague reported in the last decade. None were fatal, although an Oregon man lost his fingers and toes to it a few years ago. He'd gotten the disease from his cat while trying to pry a mouse out of its throat.
It's still kind of surprising, though, that plague continues to exist, because you think of it as something from the Middle Ages.
Right, right. But it still continues to this day. I was working in New Mexico with a student for a next generation radio project about a decade ago, and we actually visited a facility where they keep samples of the plague in a special lab. And, yeah, it's still out there. It still exists. We think of it as a relic of the Middle Ages, but it's still very much a part of our modern life. It's just more better controlled and addressed with antibiotics.
Karen, anything you want to mention about this week's news?
I was actually kind of away from the news this week, which is sometimes a really refreshing thing. But I was busy with a couple of all-day projects. Help out at a track meet yesterday, which is really from dawn till dusk.
You're running from the news.
So, yeah, well, yes. I wasn't doing the running, but I guess I was running the meet. So, yeah, I, a couple things popped up as I was going to and from, but I'm glad for this podcast to kind of refresh everything for me as well. So,
great.
Yeah.
Well, Ani, of course, has her finger on the pulse hosting Morning Edition. And I know you and I both enjoyed one story that we heard this week.
I think we have a date coming up, actually. I think you and I are going to head down to Musso and Frank Grill in Los Angeles. And I checked out the pictures this morning from this great story, very sound-rich story that Susan Stamberg did, I believe it was Wednesday. And it looks like something straight out of Mad Men. I mean, beautiful red leather booths, a rich, dark bar, and the food sounds great. I mean, they mix a classic gin martini. You can do vodka with lemon, with olives, and they offer really, really classic dishes like kidneys, liver, Welsh rarebit. So I think we should go. I think we should try a few things together and see if it's as good as it sounded.
Yeah, it's celebrating 100 years, and Susan Stamberg brought us in and took us on a little culinary journey.
What we do is we don't shake them.
Sonny Donato has been making Musso's famous $13 martini for 7 years.
We stir the ice that keeps the alcohol from being what they call bruised. We have all of our glassware chilled.
Gin or vodka?
Well, traditional, always gin.
Olives or lemon peel?
We go olives unless people specify.
It's always about what the customer wants. Full disclosure, we are recording at 11 a.m. For journalistic integrity, this reporter felt obligated to try the martini. Oh, my goodness. Perfection.
And I had one more thing, too, to throw in. This is going out to all the fish fans.
So you're talking about fish with the P-H, right? Not fish with an F.
True. Yes, yes. This is the what many people call the jam band fish. If you're really heavily into this group and like to talk about it from a scholarly perspective, there's a 3-day event at Oregon State University waiting just for you. The conference takes this approach of the band and their music, their influences, and they have all these sessions, probably about maybe 20 different sessions from first glance, with titles like Fish, the good breast and examination of the fish phenomenon and the extensive dedication of their fans with an object relations and attachment theory approach. That's just one session. Another one says, breathing deep in a steam dream, structural fog, and the persistence of groove in a split open and melt jam, just to name a few.
And, of course, Brian reported on that this week, and you can find that story and all the other stories we discussed at our website, klcc.org. Thanks for joining us this week for the Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm reporter Brian Bull.
Reporter Karen Richards.
And host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.